السلام عليكم يا جماعة. الصرخة اللي راح نطلقها الآن هي صرخة كل لاجئ وكل فلسطيني بآمن إنه الحق بموت. هذا الهتاف مش مجرد كلمات، هو جولة في جغرافيا الوطن اللي محفور بقلوبنا، من القدس لغزة ومن جبل النار للرملة وبيسان. احنا اليوم بنجدد العهد وبنقول للعالم اجمع انه الطريق مهما طال نهايته واحدة وهي العودة. انا راح القي كلمات، وكل اللي بطلب منكم انكم تزلزلوا المكان بكلمة واحدة، كلمة هي وعد وقرار. Everyone repeat after me just the word راجع. راجع انا راجع. راجع انا راجع. راجع يا بلادي. راجع يا بلادي. على ارض الخضرة. على ارض الخضرة. لنشوف الاقصى. لنشوف الاقصى. في يوم العودة. في يوم العودة. ما ننسى بلادي. ما ننسى بلادي. بنغني فيها. بنغني فيها. داري يا احبابي. داري يا احبابي. تستنى فيكم. تستنى فيكم. على جنين. على جنين. عجبال النار. عجبال النار. عالقدس وغزة. عالقدس وغزة. عالد والرملة. عالد والرملة. عابر السابع. عابر السابع. على بيسان. على بيسان. على طوباس. على طوباس. مع كل الناس. مع كل الناس. عفلسطين. عفلسطين. راجع يا بلادي. راجع يا بلادي. Thank you level.
Kunstner-samtaler med Torbjørn Sandberg Andersen.
Velkommen til aftens udsendelse. Mit navn er Torbjørn Sagmann Andersen. Det er mig en fornøjelse i dag at præsentere projektet, der hedder Den Udvidede Biograf. Det er på engelsk altså The Expanded Cinema. Det er et projekt, der er kørt af engelske kunstnere, engelsk-amerikanske kunstnere Jim Hobbs og Andrew Hill. Og vi hørte lige et lille udpluk af en lydoptagelse fra Athen, som de har foretaget en biograf der. Jim Hobbs kommer med her på telefonen her om lidt, fra England. Han er en samtidskunstner og lektor ved Greenwich University i England. Og sammen med hans kollega og samarbejdspartner fra Greenwich, Andrew Hill, der har de netop været på Cinemateket med en filmforevisning, som de kaldte for, altså for Den Udvidede Biograf. Her så man 16mm filmprojektioner, altså gammeldags film, både stå og blive betjent direkte i biografsalen blandt publikum. Her var varierende billeder fra både kendte kunstnere som Stan Brakhage, Mary Ellen Bute og David Leisner. Og lyden var altså en live lyd, der både var elektronisk og ekstrapoleret direkte fra filmen på en kompliceret måde, som jeg håber, at Jim Hobbs vil fortælle os mere om i vores interview lige her om et øjeblik. Lydene, vi hører, er fra Athen, fra projektet Image Sounds, der foregik der, og vi får nu en spoken word oplæsning, film, live lyd til film, og det er med Jim Hobbs, Andrew Hill og stemme af Maria Glica. Værsgo. Yes, and what we heard here was a reading from Athens by Maria Glika and with sound by Andrew Hill and Jim Hobbs. And I've got Jim with me now, I think, on the phone. Can you hear me now, Jim?
Yep, you're good.
There,
I can hear you.
There it goes. Yeah. Thank you. I just had to set one last button before everything worked, but it seems to be working great. Okay, hi, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Toby. How are you?
Good. So you were over here in Denmark, in Copenhagen, to visit the Cinematheque recently.
We were there last Friday night. Well, we were actually there on Thursday night. We did a talk at 68 Art Institute, a small gallery there in Copenhagen, and then we performed live at the Cinematheque on Friday.
Great. So that was a double bill, and I got to see the showing in the Cinematheque. It's a film and sound piece that you've toured. You've been in Athens, and I believe you've been somewhere else as well.
Yeah, it's a project that actually started in New York, where I was doing a kind of a collaborative work with a film arts organization called Mono Noir, and they hooked us up with the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. And so it was a research project that sort of looked at not only my work and Andrew's work, but also kind of the larger sort of history of expanded cinema, experimental cinema, but how sounds and images come together. And we were able to sort of work with the archive at the New York Public Library and kind of create a program that explored sort of image and sounds. Then that's what's now been sort of brought abroad this year, so to the UK, to Greece, and then also to Copenhagen, to Denmark.
Great. And I'm wondering, could you tell me something about the kind of films it is? Because obviously now we are on the radio, and maybe you could just introduce briefly a little bit what kind of movies it was you selected.
Sure thing. One of the things that I like about even this conversation we're having right now is the liveness of it. And I think this idea of being live is really exciting. So with the films that we chose, we wanted to choose films that could possibly be not necessarily screened, but performed live to. And I think the importance here is the idea of liveness and how that kind of it adds to the experience of watching this type of program. So my curation, I chose these films based on what I found at the New York Public Library in their archive. And I was led not necessarily by anything really specific about, say, a curatorial practice, but rather images or films that seemed to have some resonance with me and within my own work. And so I spent 3 days there going through kind of a lot of their catalog about what they had. And I was drawn to things that were also quite abstract. So, for example, Mary Ellen Butte, which we just heard Maria Glika's response to, that was really important to me because that was one of the first films that ever really sort of brought together this idea of sounds and images. And the idea of rhythm and light is the idea that the sonic and how it influences these kind of abstract images. And for Maria to be able to respond in her own way is kind of an interesting sort of newer take on it. So part of the reasons that we were looking at films of that nature was also to look at the historical nature of them, but also then apply something kind of new to them. So across the board, we've had those types of films. So there was Stan Brakhage, who did Garden of Earthly Delights, which was actually meant to be silent, which was quite nice because the visuals do create the sound. All the way through to, we had Bruce Conner's Cosmic Ray, which included Ray Charles. It's almost like one of the first pop videos ever made, for lack of a better description. It's a little bit more than that, but really exciting to see how sound works with that. And then we also coupled it with some of these other films that we brought in from contemporary artists. So to pair those up and to write some new sort of soundtracks or sound responses maybe is the best way to describe it. And that's how we then worked with some of the other people that I know here in London or in the UK that I thought their work would sit well within that canon of sort of experimental cinema, but also the possibility of how we could actually add sounds to that as well.
Great. So just to go back, one of the people you mentioned, Mary Ellen Butte, that's, I believe, yep, the oldest piece that's in the screening. Is that correct?
That's correct. That film from 19... Yeah, that's from 1936. And again, one of the beauties of working with sort of an archive is that you have access to a lot of these films. And again, it was very special and very important to understand that bringing these films sort of abroad or bringing them as a touring program, it's not just about playing a file or having a projection. It's actually the whole experience of watching it on film. And if you think about the idea of how light passes through film, it becomes a much more sort of experiential kind of program as opposed to just simply watching a film.
Yes, I said that in the introduction in Danish, which you didn't hear. Great. Because you weren't caught in at that time. But I mentioned just really briefly that it's the idea of the expanded cinema as you showed it in the Cinematheque was that you had the setup where you had actual film projectors, like the old kind, so to say, but film projectors that you had standing in amongst the audience, really, in the room.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that it's very interesting because sometimes it's very difficult to get these films or to work with certain people who hold archives. But when working with the New York Public Library, I was working with a woman named Eleanor Rossi Snook, who's been amazing, and we talked about the program and the idea that the projectors were going to be in the space with the people. And again, the experience of cinema that isn't just merely sitting down in comfortable chairs and watching something and being entertained, but rather the idea of the physicality that can happen when you watch these things, but also experience the sound. And one of the great things that happened at the Cinematheque is Oscar Peterson, we worked really hard with him and all of the technicians there to patch all of our live sounds into the sound system in the cinema. So again, it was about using the cinema as a space where people normally come to watch films, but at the same time kind of try and just tweak the use of that space into a way that allowed it to be more expansive and probably, you know, to use it in a way that isn't necessarily traditional. And I have to say that the technicians were just brilliant. They loved the idea of trying to figure these problems out and, you know, to challenge the cinema as a space was fantastic to work with these guys. They were really up for it and they solved the problems and just big shout out to them. They were great. They were absolutely fantastic.
I mean, as you describe it here, I certainly recognize that from the experience in the Cinematheque, it was a very physical experience. Like the film and the way you sit watching, you can practically feel the film reel roll through the projectors. You can certainly hear it, the flapping, and a lot of the films that you've picked also have a lot of physicality to them. They're very dynamic.
Yeah, I think they all, I mean, again, there was quite a range across them. And, you know, I think Guy Sherwin and Lin Lu's piece was really exciting, you know, where they've just literally taken washi tape, Japanese washi tape, and placed it onto clear film.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt. What is washi tape?
Okay, so washi tape is kind of a decorative tape it's used in a lot of places, but its origin is Japanese. So it's kind of a decorative tape that is used, you know, for wrapping packages and things like that.
Okay.
It's semi-transparent or semi-translucent. And what they had done with that piece was simply to cut it into certain lengths and then allow that to then run through the projector. So you have these sort of abstract lines, but at the same time, there's a real physicality to it. So like any time that you're using projections, you know, the idea of a projection is it's making something larger. It's sending something out across space. So every time you sort of take a piece of washi tape, there's just a little bit of, you know, fibrous hairs and things like that. So it gives it that sense of depth. And again, that whole thing about when you show things on film, the idea that you're passing light through a physical material, there automatically is a sense of depth within that. And I think that physicality comes through in almost all of them, from the scratches to, you know, just the real sort of raw physicality of, say, someone like Bruce Conner's film. And even Dave Lester's film, I thought, the way that he had printed it, it's just got this kind of almost three-dimensionality to it that is really, really heavy.
And I'm just going to say that, yeah, so David Lester, we heard a little bit of the excerpt from the audio from his piece. It's a piece that you and Andrew have rescored the piece, made a new soundtrack, if you want. And also, I would say one more note here. When we saw when we spoke of Mary Ellen Bute and that piece, which is the oldest piece in the show, it's 80 years old, roughly, and it's you've got a new live score for that as well. That piece, I'm just going to try to describe it a little bit because I'm thinking that as we are talking about these physicalities, in a way, I think that one thing that's good to think about is that piece. So can you describe what you see in something like the Mary Ellen Bute piece? Maybe you could do it better. You know it inside out, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was laughing. I was thinking about how are we going to do this on the radio, talking about film and images, you know, without using words. Yes. And it is a difficult thing to explain. But I think for me, I would call it it's using film and light and sort of abstract sculptures in a way that is filmed so as to remove the location of those things. So what you're left with are what might be as simple as a bit of timber that's been lit in a certain way that the camera moves across it, or they're using double exposures or mirrors to create these patterns across the film. And so they dance, they move, they shift. So moving a light source from one side to another of an object starts to create this kind of movement. So even if the camera isn't moving, these abstract forms are starting to come into vision. Okay, and what's interesting about that is that the film is quite abstract up until there's one point where she shows these kind of sparklers. They're kind of like fireworks.
Yes,
and you can recognize them instantly. And I think in a way, when I see something like that, I've been taken on this abstract trip, and the sounds that we sort of generate with that. And you know, again, Stefan Levering is the one who did the soundtrack or the sound response at the Cinematheque there, but at that point, when you suddenly are revealed that you realize that what this person's been doing is using just these basic elements and has created this kind of magical abstract landscape, that's kind of what's happening within that film. And I love that. And again, so how sound then can respond to that and open it up even further is really exciting.
Great. Yep. I agree with you completely, and I've got to say that Stefan Levering, I don't think we'll have his live music score from Cinematheque with us. So what I have is I have the recordings from the project you did in Athens, and we heard a little bit of David Lester's piece, and I promise I will play that piece again at some other point, but maybe not. If not today, then another day.
Great.
And...
Yep.
Sorry, I have to redo that part. I missed out that piece on the audio. So I'm just going to ask you that question again. I think I got faded out at the wrong time. So I'm going to try to do a rewind. So David Lester's piece, we have that on audio from Athens. I'm going to play that again at some other time, if not today, then another day. And my next question was, if you would tell us a little bit about how you and Andrew Hill are working together, because all the audio we have today that we heard in the beginning of the program and that we will continue with after the two of us have spoken here is taken in Athens very recently and just before you came to Cinematheque, really. And the two of you are the people who are in the cinema running the audio and the visuals. And how does your collaboration work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting one because I think as Andrew and I have continued to tour the project, like with anything, you start to recognize, you start to develop a relationship, so it starts to shift or change. There are some basic elements of the sound that Andrew has done prior to the performances. So there are, in certain cases, some bass layer tracks that we're putting down. And that comes down to Andrew actually scoring the material and the thing that we started to realize, though, is that in terms of this live performance, what we really wanted to work with was this idea of texture and sound and space. And so it's very difficult to just sort of say that we're just Jim's in charge of the projectors and Andrew's in charge of the sound. So what we started to do is, you know, I'm coming in a little bit and actually adding other elements in as well. So Andrew has his sort of gear that he's working with, mostly electronic things that are sort of manipulating sound noises or electrical currents. And at the same time, I might be working more physically, working with sort of contact mics and trying to generate sounds that way. And how we sort of work together is there's this kind of, you get a feeling. And so as I look over at Andrew, especially I think for the final piece, which is called Vientos Fuertes, which you might end up playing an excerpt of that here in a minute, we really are sort of improvising. And in a way, I'm pulling optical sound off of the projectors, while at the same time, Andrew is manipulating some of those sounds live, and we're going back and forth. And I sort of look at Andrew, not like a conductor, but as a collaborator. And I look at him and it's like, okay, now it's time to change. I'm going to put on these other sort of loops of films that are going to sort of move the viewers into another space. We're going to go very, very abstract. Let's start to crank it up. Let's get it really loud. I want to take people into a chaotic space because that's the way the film's going. That's the way that we sort of talk to each other. And again, it's developed over time. So I think we have a good understanding of each other while we try and figure these things out. Okay. And again, that's all very much about the liveness of it as well. So again, to be able to sort of do that live, and again, you respond to the space as well and what the space needs. So for example, on the David Lester track of Headgear, it was very much about trying to sort of feel that space and how much we crank it up, or how sort of angry Andrew gets. He has a contact mic onto a piece of slate with a piece of paper on there. So he's drawing these lines, but it's the sound of the pencil scraping, and then that mixed with a pencil hitting a contact mic, and sort of all of these things become very physical. While on the film itself, there's a person taking measurements of someone's head and actually taking down notes. So it's ironic that the sound of what a pencil might make is then sort of transformed into this very, very odd and alien sound.
Yeah. Again, it's hard to describe that sound. We'll play it again later, and we'll probably, maybe the listeners will be able to recognize the sound of something just being scratched across a surface, basically, as if you would, like a child would, you know, will play with a ruler across a wooden desk or something like that. So that's the kind of sounds we're looking at, which is mixed in, as you say, with a lot of other electro sounds, and some of them, again, they're coming directly from the film, and the film, the light and the print of the film is being run through the audio track. So the visuals, in a way, becomes the... It gets quite technical. It gets kind of nerdy, Jim, I have to say.
Yeah, it is. It's sometimes very difficult to explain how those sounds or those noises are generated. And again, it does come down to the materiality of film itself. And film, basically you're using a 16mm film projector in a way that isn't just about projecting the image. You're actually using the image to disrupt the optical soundtrack, which then in turn creates or generates these noises. And for me, it is a technical thing, but it's a very simple, basic, primal thing. And you mentioned a child sort of dragging a ruler. It's as soon as you remove the image of a child dragging a ruler, that sound becomes something so other. And if we open ourselves up to the fact that it's not a child dragging a ruler, instead it's a sound that is about dragging, or a sound that is about stopping the light from coming somewhere, then suddenly you can start to begin to realize that these sounds actually have a lot more meaning than just simply sort of being the thing that it's associated with. It's the diegetic versus non-diegetic sounds, the sounds that aren't on the screen. They're coming from other places, you know?
And have you heard yourself the soundtrack from these events? Because I was... really surprised to hear it when I listened back to it. I of course, what you're talking about now, when I saw the sounds, you know, I saw the sounds, of course I didn't, I heard the sounds, but I saw the images, and it makes so much that you kind of, your consciousness or what you want is like moving between the two of them with a different kind of a movement between the eye and the ear. And when I listened back to the soundtrack, I got a very, very different experience, a great experience. I was really positively surprised. I was like, oh my God, this sound is so great, and it has a lot more to offer than I actually thought immediately. I'm sorry to that's rude, but I experienced it. But when I listened back to it, I really thought there was a lot more to it.
Yeah. It's funny for me, I think anybody who does performance, it's very difficult to go back to any sort of recordings or documentation of it, because when you do perform live, you're just in it. And it's as if saying that you're so conscious, you're in the moment. Instead, you are just moving through this thing. And then when you come back and you sort of hear or you see these things, they do take on sort of a different life. It feels like, I find it very difficult that we're even the authors of that sometimes, you know, because those sounds that were created are so removed from the experience that I and Andrew probably had delivering that. And I should say as well that on the end of that recording, Vasilis Vlastaras was also there making some noises as well. And again, it added just this other element into it. And that part of that improvisation that was happening, where you bring in these other people to sort of challenge your own way of kind of performing, that was a very large part of how we approached this project. So by bringing in other artists, sound artists or visual artists, it shifted every place we went. So every time that program was played or sort of performed, it was something new. So no matter what, even though it might be the same sort of materials going through a certain chronology or a certain order, they're always different. Every time it was different. And so to go back and to listen to that recording is something quite special and something quite bespoke in terms of what actually happened in Athens.
Sorry, I'm just going to have to retake that. That was an error again. I suggest here that we take a really listen to a really small excerpt just to get to visualize. I was going to say, is there a word for eerie eyes? To visualize for our ears what it is we're talking about, because I have the recording from Athens playing. I can mix it in and we can just listen to it for a minute or something, and that's where we are at. That's what we are talking about.
Yeah, so great.
I'll do that now.
Great.
Just a really brief interlude there. It was a bit more howling. I'm going to play the full piece later. It's about about 30 minutes worth of. And did you have the title for that particular piece? It's the piece at the end where you and Andrew are kind of freestyling or something like this. I don't know how to describe it. You must have this film clips prepared to quite large degree, but on the other hand, it seems as you have a space to improvise in as well.
This is the piece. I wasn't able to hear it, but I'm assuming this is the piece that had the windmills. Is that correct?
Yes. When you showed it, you had a shot of a windmill just turning around, just really focused on the actual mill part of it. And you had, in Copenhagen, you showed these kind of clouds that look kind of almost artificial, and you move that image in and out of the windmill image. So while you see the sky behind the windmill, you have these clouds that kind of pop into that image and then leave it again in a strange way.
I mean, that piece, I mean, it's interesting for me. I mean, in terms of my artwork or where things come from or where the inception or the concepts begin to sort of come from, I mean, a lot of it sort of stemmed from a walk that I did. I live now, not necessarily in London, I live on the south coast of England now. And out where I'm at, there's a wind farm with all these large turbines. Mm-hmm. And I've always, you know, I come from a sculptural background. And so these windmills that are kind of take up the landscape in a way are quite magnificent in terms of sculpture, in terms of kind of monoliths. And as I was walking through them, you get this amazing sense of physicality. So if anybody's ever been underneath a turbine, you know, you can feel their power. I know they generate power, but the way in which they move is sort of scary, but at the same time, beautiful. And I think when I first had that experience of going near these things, I immediately was reading Cervantes, and I was reading Don Quixote, and I was kind of thinking about what an experience might be of kind of tying these two things together, of what would it be like to try and charge at one of these wind turbines like Quixote had done, and to get sort of thrown into it and then spit out the other side. So just to take a very simple experience of what it might be to be churned out by a wind turbine, that's kind of where the concept of it really came from. And so how do you sort of translate that into this kind of experience? So it starts out with something very pensive, very slow, and trying to sort of almost idolize this monolith. You know, you can think about, you know, sort of 2001 and Stanley Kubrick and this idea of this sort of this monolith thing that sort of stands in the landscape. And it's something to sort of be in awe of. There's also something very hypnotic about watching something just sort of spin. You know, it's like watching a fire. It feels very primal to me. And I'm also thinking about the idea of loops and the way in which this